my name's Lydia. I'm an alcoholic. I thought there would be more reading, so I was like, oh, okay, I'm just going to go on up there then. And so I got gum in my mouth. And apologize. My sobriety date is May 9th of 1998, and I have a home group and a sponsor. And I'm very privileged and grateful to call myself a sponsor. I get to sponsor women in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's truly been a bright spot of my life and something that has really kept me accountable and inside the principles and the steps and the message of Alcoholics Anonymous in a way that nothing else ever has, you know. And I've learned the most about myself as a person, as a woman, as a human being, as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, as a daughter, as a friend, through the women that I sponsor. And it is it's a great privilege to be asked to come here today and to tell you my story. And thank you so much to Billy and Lynn and Salt of the Earth, you know, such lovely, wonderful people. And I've had the privilege of coming down to the Sunday night meeting, and I got to speak there about this time last year, and my entire life had, like, literally just fallen apart. So I was like, I don't even know what I'm going to say, but I'm just going to get up there and try and be as honest as I can. And they, you know, graciously listened to me. and I got to stay sober another day, and the days have ticked by, and I've been sober another year. And if I make it on the 9th of May, I'll be celebrating 14 years of continuous sobriety. And I never thought that something like that would be possible for a person like me. Never. I love to get drunk. You know, I was going to say I love alcohol, but I don't really. It tastes bad. It, like, makes me feel sick. But I love the feeling of being very, very, very drunk. I'm definitely an alcoholic, and I'm a little bit nervous today. I wasn't nervous at all. Actually, we had an awesome ride down here. A couple of my very... I was going to say old friends. They're not old, but we've been friends for a very long time. we've been friends my entire sobriety, and a woman that I sponsor. We drove down here this morning, and we had a great car ride. We talked about our past experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous and what's going on with us today. And I didn't feel nervous at all until about 2 minutes ago. But that is my privilege to... And it's just my turn. That's the most basic thing that I think that we're asked to do here in Alcoholics Anonymous, is to share our experience. And it tells us that right at the beginning of the book, you know, that this program is based on one alcoholic sharing with another alcoholic their experience, strength, and hope, you know. So that's what I'm going to try and do to the best of my ability today. Like I said, I love to be drunk. I really relate to that part in the Big Book where it talks about the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. You know, I was rarely mildly intoxicated. I was more or less always insanely drunk. And when I took a drink of alcohol, I had a complete personality change. And I actually didn't realize, like, the extent to which I had a personality change until this past year. Actually, I ran into an old friend of mine who I used to drink with, and life has taken him on to better things, and we had a very honest conversation about our drinking histories, and he told me, he was like, I never understood. He was like, I was a heavy drinker for that time in my life, but I never understood what alcohol did for you. It was like you had a complete personality change. And I was like, whoa, that's exactly what it says in our literature, you know? And I did, you know. I've always felt very uncomfortable inside my own skin. From my earliest memories, I just didn't feel right. I felt like everybody else had some sort of secret thing that they were in on, or they were all a part of a club that I just didn't understand. And I felt like I was terrified to open my mouth because some weird thing might come out, and then you would judge me and not want me to be in your club. So I was often very quiet. And when I did say things, I would invariably say the wrong thing and feel ostracized. And this is all internal. There's not actually really anything going on out there for real. It was all inside my head and inside my mind. And I felt like, thank God, when I was 8 years old, and I had my first real drink of alcohol. My family, my father was a college professor, And he was doing some work in Italy, and he brought the family with him to do this work, and we were there for a long time, and was with a lot of other college students, and who, you know, they thought it was cute to, like, give the 8-year-old a little glass of red wine. What they didn't understand, though, was that this was the beginning of an obsession, you know, that it instantly did something for me that nothing had ever done for me before. I suddenly felt like I could say things that were coming to my mind, and that I was the center of attention, and that I was cute, and that, you know, people liked to be around me, and you know, and these were obviously, like, kids in their, like, 20s, and, you know, I was 8, you know, like, who wants to hang out with the 8-year-old, you know, to party, you know, but that really started the romance. With alcohol, and that's exactly what it was. It was romantic. It was a great love story for a while. We were just talking in a meeting the other night about how all obsession is a lie. It was a third step meeting, and someone shared that all obsession is a lie because it means that we're living in the I'll be happy when's, you know? And it was like, that was like the story of my existence for as long as I drank, you know? I will be happy as long as I can get something. As long as I can get something to take this edge off, something that's gonna take away that editor, that constant critical editor that lives inside my head and tells me that I'm doing everything wrong, or that I'm a piece of crap, or everybody else is better than me, or if only I had her looks or his smarts, or, you know, that family, that I would be better, that I'd be okay, you know. And I obviously did not become a daily drinker at the age of 8. But I grew up in an alcoholic household. My dad just celebrated 10 years of continuous sobriety on the 26th of December. So Christmas 10 years ago was a bad day. But it's been a really great Christmas every year since. And so I can say that. I can say that. It was definitely an alcoholic home. My dad comes from a very large Irish Catholic drinking family. And He was a fun drunk. He made the idea of getting drunk seem like pleasurable. I mean, pleasurable. He wasn't a violent drunk. He wasn't any of those things. He wasn't scary when he was drinking. He was really fun. He would tell these stories, and he was hilarious, you know, hilarious. And my dad was like my hero. You know, I loved hanging out with Dad, especially when he was 3 sheets to the wind. So, I mean, it was easy to sneak some drinks, you know. He had a little liquor cabinet, and he never knew how much was in there or not in there. I remember him constantly coming home with, like, new gigantic bottles of, I think he liked bourbon and sometimes whiskey, but not often. So I knew to stay away from the whiskey because he'd be more likely to figure out that I had taken some. But by the time I was a teenager, you know, by the time I'd gotten to high school, I was pouring a little bit of this and a little bit of that into, like, an empty container, and we called it suicide juice because it tasted, like, disgusting. I mean, like, you couldn't even smell this stuff without thinking you were going to retch on yourself. But it did the trick, you know. It was very potent, and it got me very drunk. And I started stealing bottles of wine from my parents. Like, had a little rack. It wasn't even like a... They didn't have, like, a wine collection or anything. They had a little rack, and all of these bottles had sentimental value, which I didn't care about. I did not care about my parents' sentimental value with these bottles of wine. Apparently, my dad had purchased a bottle the day my brother was born in 1972, and then a bottle the day that I was born in 1978, and I drank them. I didn't care. I had no idea. And I loved how drunk I could get after just a couple of glasses of red wine. I mean, red wine really did something special for me. Insanely inebriated, you know. I couldn't wait to get to high school because I knew that there would probably be drugs there. And this is Alcoholics Anonymous, but it's very difficult for me to not mention drugs when I'm telling my story. And I will tell you right now that I use drugs alcoholically. I used them for the same reason and the same effect that I drank alcohol. I got sober at the age of 20. I never took a legal drink of alcohol. Drugs were simply easier and less, you know, less of a pain in the butt to get. And oftentimes it was cheaper because I was underage. I would have to spend a lot of money and a lot of effort in order to get what I needed in the quantities that I needed them. And as alcoholism progressed in me, I did more and more, slipped more and more into that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization that the Big Book talks about in order to get what I needed. But at that time, it was like the world was my oyster, and I was about to start high school, and there was all these exciting, this exciting prospect of getting really messed up, and spiritual likes attract, so immediately, I don't know if I found them or if they found me, but one way or another, I was in with a crowd who was skipping class every day, and there was this one guy lived in this disgusting house. I don't think he had parents. And if he did, they just didn't live there. And it was absolutely disgusting. And it was actually like very recently that I realized, because I was listening to a close friend of mine has just one of these horrible drug addiction stories where she lived in the crack house and, you know, all this stuff. And I was like, man, I don't have a story like that. You know, feeling like less than in Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, my story isn't good enough because I didn't live in a crack house. And man, she's got the crack house story. You know? And I recall I had a visual recollection of what it was like to hang out in this house. It was like piles of garbage, piles of, you couldn't see the carpet. And the carpet was once like a beige color, and now it was like a grayish, just a filthy, disgusting place, but I didn't see it that way because that was the place, that was the haven, that was the place where it was okay to go and get drunk like I like to get drunk and act how I like to act when I get drunk. So it was like always a party, and like those were the good old days, like those were the golden days, I would go to my first period class because it was PE, it was physical education. And it was my goal to piss off the physical education teacher to the point where she would send me to the principal's office, which almost always happened towards the end because I didn't want to, they make you dress up in that little uniform, and I thought this was degrading. And so I would give a speech, I would say, this is why I think I should not have to do, and she'd say, just go, So I would, instead of going to the principal's office, like many people witnessed me crossing the sports field and off into the distance, like down the road to where my friend's house was, where I would proceed to get drunk. And so many days, right teetering right on that edge of like passing out, but knowing that I had to walk home. I didn't get my driver's license until I was almost 19 years old, partially because I never left Arlington. I grew up in Arlington, Virginia. And it's a big enough yet small enough place where you don't really have to drive if you're not interested in doing anything with your life. I mean, I could walk to the metro if I wanted to go downtown. I could I could walk to all of my friends' houses where I could get what I needed. And there was something very scary about the idea of me having a driver's license. And I knew that intuitively. On an intuitive level, I knew that I was probably not the type of person that should have that privilege. So I would skip class every day and try and get myself home. And then my parents just became this obstacle. My dad was cool, because most of the time he was too drunk as well to notice, what bad shape I was in when I came through the door. But my mom wasn't, My mom is like a very good Al-Anon candidate, and she unfortunately at that time, having lived with my dad's alcoholism for so long and then watching her daughter's alcoholism progress, had slipped into I don't see anything. I see nothing, So she just became this object. I objectified her. She's just this person that I have to get through, like the gatekeeper, And once I get past her, everything's going to be all right. I'll just get up to my room where I can smoke cigarettes out the window, and I had my little bong that I could smoke, and the little stashes of booze, different places when I hadn't run out, and that's the way that I lived. And I thought I was truly, and I think that a lot of us are like this, my own worst enemy. I just hated myself. I could not stand the person that I saw looking back at me in the mirror. I hated that girl. And it was many years into sobriety before I was actually able to look at myself, like really look at myself in the mirror and be okay with what I saw, you know, if not feel full of shame. But I thought, no one will ever love me, you know. I was a tomboy. I was always a tomboy. I wanted to look as scary as possible so that you wouldn't actually get to know me, so that you wouldn't want to talk to me. So, you know, that last year that I was actually attending high school, I was always, you know, my uniform was like Doc Martens, black jeans, Metallica t-shirt, you know, black nail polish. You know, I shaved part of my head at one point, and I never smiled. You know, a smile went with nothing. So, just, you know, I can't even do it. I can't even replicate it for you now. I'm just too happy these days, is what I was going to say before the higher power intervened. I was a really scary person. At some point at the beginning of high school, this guy had found me, and he drank the way that I drank, and he looked older, and he had a fake ID. And so we became, you know, like inseparable. We were always drinking together. It was always violent, you know. And the two always existed together. He was only violent when we were drunk. And I became very talented at pushing the buttons because it fit into a certain story that I had to tell myself. I had to tell myself that I was a victim. I was a victim of this man. I was a victim of his rage. I was a victim of his love, you know, that I couldn't possibly leave him because no one else in the world would ever love me. And what I came to see through coming into sobriety and working through the steps was that this was a very convenient story for me. You know, he provided the alcohol, he provided the drugs, he had all the connections, and I loved that sense of being the victim. You know, that I could, my old grand sponsor talks about, like, you know, the resentment and the victimization becomes like a woolly sweater. You know, that I could just cuddle up in, and it's itchy and it's uncomfortable, but man, it's like the only thing I've ever known, you know. And I loved the fact that he was abusive to me because then I could turn it around on all my friends and say, do you see what I have to put up with? I have to drink like this just in order to get through it, you know? And I really thought that, I was so insane that I thought the only way I'm ever going to get out of this situation is if he kills me or if he leaves me. And, he didn't kill me, obviously, because I'm still standing here. But he did leave. He went away to college down in Florida. And at this time, you know, I had tried a lot of different things. I had tried the experiment of being a drug dealer because it seemed like a good economy. You know, it was like a good idea that I could have all these things that I wanted and never have to pay for them. And there was a certain amount of ego involved in that, you know, that I could be this badass girl that, like, nobody messed with because she's got the stuff that you need. And I was terrible at it. And I failed at it pretty quickly because I couldn't stop using my own product, mainly. And also because I was just really bad at it. I didn't charge enough, all this stuff. Whatever. A friend of mine had... around this time, you know, I was about 19 years old, and by the skin of my teeth, I had dropped out of high school, and I started going to what they call in Arlington County the adult education program, which was really like a bunch of teenagers like me who couldn't stand it, who couldn't stand high school, couldn't stand other people, couldn't stand the way they felt in their own skin, and they were just trying to, like, make mom and dad happy by you know, getting some sort of degree. And we would in the parking lot of the school, we would bring all of our cars together and pass the bottle back and forth out the window, and like nobody stopped us. And I remember being just completely insanely drunk in class almost all the time, to the point where I would walk up to ask if I could use the bathroom and be like, God, the bathroom. And like one of my teachers told me later, she couldn't believe that I would come back. I would go to the bathroom, and then I would come back and sit in class. And she's like, I never thought that you would come back. And, like, you kept coming back. I just couldn't believe it. You were so drunk. And, like, I thought, you know, like, believing, I thought I was getting away with it, you know. I thought that I was keeping the secret, you know, that I was playing it off and getting away with it. But somehow I managed to graduate And I had all these ideas, you know, my dad being the college professor, and my mom had her own career. She went back to school in her adulthood when I was a teenager and got a master's degree. And so I had these ideas of, like, who I wanted to be and who I thought that I would be. And it included, you know, like, getting an education and being a sharp mind and all of this stuff. And, like, I just couldn't do it, you know, like, the terror. I was so absolutely terrified of everybody and everything, like the world, the big world, you know. And so I signed up for classes and I couldn't show up. I would drive to the parking lot at college and I would sit there in the car and, like, give myself a little pep talk in the rearview mirror. You know, like, you're going to do this. You're going to go in there. You're going to take notes. And you're going to look like you know what you're doing. And it's going to be fine. It's going to be okay. And then I would just drive away. You know, I, like, couldn't. I just could not do it. And I was working a job. They put me in a position of trust because, you know, we're very good at that. We're very good at doing above and beyond when we show up, you know. And that was my experience. It was like when I showed up, I was the best employee they'd ever had. The problem was getting me to actually show up for work, you know, because most of the time I stayed out too late. I was too drunk when I woke up in the morning, you know, still drunk from the night before, or, you know, found myself with, like, some sort of bruises or some other calamity had befallen me, and I just couldn't show my face at work that next morning, you know. But they had given me a lot of responsibility, and I had keys to the place and, like, all this stuff, and I've quickly figured out how to use this to my benefit, and I was stealing everything that I could get. I was stealing cash, I was stealing merchandise, and I roped other people that I was working with into doing this with me, and some of them paid huge consequences for that. So one of them was arrested for it, another one was fired. But I just thought, whew, thank God, you know, I got away with it. You know, I had no care or concern whatsoever for what was going on around me or the types of trouble that I caused in other people's lives, you know, how that rippled out to other people. A friend of mine around this time, he had taken me downtown to a club, and so I realized that I could actually get drunk downtown in clubs. Because they didn't card, you know. There's, like, I'm sure that there were a lot of places like this, but I didn't know of them because my entire world consisted of Arlington County. So going down to the city into D.C. to get drunk was, like, this fabulous adventure, you know. And I ended up in, like, these little teeny hole in the wall, disgusting places where you'd pay, you know, 15 times the actual worth for a beer. You know, like a $2 beer costs like $15, but I didn't care because I was drinking it in a bar, you know, wow, you know. And many times I would find myself so drunk that I couldn't remember where I parked my car, and I would end up wandering around downtown in, like, not so great areas. And a friend of mine had gotten in a lot of trouble at this time, and he was one of the only people left in my world that would drink with me the way that I wanted to drink, you know, without getting critical or mouthy or, like, trying to stop me or ask me what was wrong with me or why do I have to, you know, like, you've had enough, don't you think? Or there isn't any more. Why do we have to go on some adventure to find some? Like, just chill. He's like, you don't understand. Like, I was at this point, I was drinking to, I had to, every time that I drank, which was almost every day at this point, I had to drink to the point of passing out. I had to. I could not stand that in-between place, you know. I couldn't stand it. I wanted to be oblivious to everything. And the mind was the chatter was loud. It wouldn't turn off after a couple of drinks. It was like I had to be passing out, you know. And this one friend that I had left got in a lot of trouble, and he was told by the judge, jail or rehab. And so he chose wisely rehab. And I felt like a lot of loyalty to this particular friend, so I went to visit him a couple of times in rehab, and he told me later that I was one of the only people who came to visit him. You know how it is, like these foxhole friendships. You think we're always going to be there for each other, but at the end of the day, I mean, I was certainly that way. I didn't appreciate people shedding light on the truth about me, what was really going on with me on the inside. I wanted it to be just as fake as possible. I wanted it to be surface. I thought that surely if anybody knew what was really going on inside of me. They would run from me so fast, you know, and I would never hear from them again, and I would be alone, you know, and that terrible, all-consuming loneliness. And he told me about Alcoholics Anonymous. Went to visit him. He told me about AA. And he said something that I'll never forget. He said, "You know, Lydia, you drank like I did, and I'm here now, and I've been going to AA, and I think, you know, I think when I get out of here, I'm gonna keep going." And I thought, oh my God, you know, like my one friend I'm gonna lose him to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, like what am I gonna do? So when he got out, I went with him. I went with him to a meeting, and I've never felt like drinking as much as I did when I left that AA meeting. But I heard something, you know. I mean, it wasn't so much what I heard; it was more what I experienced, you know, which was that there was a vibration, you know, there was a tangible something, something hanging in the air, a presence, you know, that I had not experienced before, and it felt very awake and alive and real, you know. And I couldn't have articulated it at the time. I didn't know what it was. It made me feel extremely uncomfortable, just like looking in the mirror. And so I started going to AA. But I didn't commit. You know, I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't go through the steps with anybody. I remember asking a couple of people to be my sponsor, and of course they were all men. They were all married men. And then I was like, you know, wounded and offended that they all said, "I can't sponsor you, but here's my wife's number. She loves sponsoring women. Why don't you give her a call?" And did I? No, of course not. I think that I began drinking alcoholically at about the age of 16, and I really crossed the line into being a real alcoholic, as the Big Book describes. You know, a real alcoholic, where it's completely beyond my control. I'm 100% obsessed with it, and by the time I was 18, you know, and I just to backtrack a little bit, I had when I was 17 or so, you know, I got my first job. I was working at a pool during the summer, just as like a receptionist, or like a, you know, person who checks the little. You know, make sure you're a member so you can come into the pool. And I would almost always be either drunk or hungover, you know, to the point where I was passed out or asleep on the job. And they had threatened to fire me a couple of times. And, you know, the abusive boyfriend, we were going through a hiatus. And, of course, he had started dating somebody else. And it looked very much like they were in love. And I couldn't stand this idea. So I had, it was a summer day, my parents were at work, I had a bunch of people over, we got into my dad's liquor cabinet, and the thought came to my mind, you know, I'm going to kill myself, or at least I'm going to make it look like I'm going to kill myself, and that way everyone will be sorry for me, and he'll come back to me, my job will be okay, and my parents will get off my back, and like all this stuff. And my dad has a heart condition, and he takes those little nitroglycerin tablets. And I had, you know, I had done my research. I knew what would happen if I downed that entire bottle of nitroglycerin. You know, that my heart rate and my blood pressure would become so low that I would just pass out and slip away. You know, and I thought that sounded like heaven. That sounded wonderful to just slip away. You know, so I remember being so drunk that I could barely stand up at the kitchen sink. And I remember having the bottle of pills in my hand, and like cupping my hand like I was going to drink water. And the next thing I remember is I remember sort of making a phone call, I think to the ex-boyfriend. And the next thing I remember is I'm running down the street, no shoes on, screaming. My sister's on a bike. She's following me. And I'm screaming, "Why won't you just let me die? Why won't you just let me die? Like, just leave me alone. Just go back home. Just let me die." And some people, we lived by a public park, and some, you know, somehow I'd gotten cornered and like couldn't continue to run anywhere. And some people had heard me screaming, and they came down to try and feed me bread, and they had called the ambulance, and the ambulance came, and the police came, and there was like a, you know, this moment of crisis. You know, what are we going to do? What are we going to do with Lydia? And they took me to they checked my vitals, and I seemed to be okay, but just to be on the safe side because I couldn't remember what I had done. They took me to the hospital, and they pumped my stomach, which was horrible, 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 horrible experience. And my parents, being the way that they were, you know, this was embarrassing. They didn't want anybody to find out that this was going on inside their home, you know. And so we started family counseling. I wasn't institutionalized that day. I wasn't thrown in rehab. And, of course, like, I was blusterous, you know, like, if you do that to me, I'll never talk to you again. I'll get a new family someplace else, and you'll be dead to me. And, you know, their daughter had just tried to commit suicide. And I mean, I can't even imagine what must have been going through their minds, or the kind of distress that I must have caused for them that day. But they came and got me at the hospital and took me home. And a few hours later, I was out the front door going to meet my friends to get drunk again, you know. And the reason that I went back to this story is because when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous that first time, you know, when I was 19 years old, this did not seem like the right place for me. Even though I had felt this presence here, you know, and I knew that there was something very wrong with me, but I didn't think that I was an alcoholic, you know. I didn't think that it had gotten that bad, that it had gotten bad enough. And I actually ended up running into there was a young couple, a man and a woman, who had called the police that day and tried to feed me bread and had stood there with my sister and counseled her as I was having this meltdown. They came up to me in an AA meeting and they were like, "Oh my God, it's you! Like, you're still alive," you know. And it was only years later when I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous and I thought about that, you know, like how amazing that is, you know, that these people were truly practicing in some small way the 12th step of Alcoholics Anonymous. They had seen this opportunity and they had come down and just tried to be of help, you know. And I didn't end up getting sober that day. They didn't get to tell me about Alcoholics Anonymous or pick me up or take me to a meeting, but they showed up. They showed up and they were a force for good in my life that day. And by coming to meet them again in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, that set a good example for me. It set a really good example, and it's planted a seed, you know, that, like, I gotta do this. You know, I really gotta do this. But my story includes a relapse, you know, obviously. I mean, I wasn't very committed. I was like 1 foot in, 1 foot out. You know, I liked the camaraderie and I liked the fellowship, and I for the first time in my life, I felt like I had a couple of friends who were interested in doing things other than just going to get drunk. And it turned into, you know, 5 meetings a week turned into 4 meetings a week and 3 nights of laser tag, and then it turned into 7 nights of laser tag and 3 meetings a week, and like onward and onward and onward until I hadn't gone to a meeting in several weeks, and I felt like I didn't need it anymore. My life was okay. You know, I had all these things on the eye. I had gotten a new car. My parents trusted me again. There was even, you know, even talk of them helping me to move out and me going to college full time and all this stuff, you know. And I got itchy. You know, I was about 11 months from being separated from alcohol, not sober, but separated from alcohol, and the desire and opportunity crossed. You know, I'd had the desire many nights, but on this particular one, the two things crossed at the same time. You know, and I found myself once again full of shame, full of fear. I had done things that I said I would never do. That one time, just drinking one night, you know, it was hell. It was literal hell. And I remember that my mind didn't shut off. It didn't shut off. It was like that moment, you know, someone had put a beer in my hand, and I was like, am I about to do this? Am I really about to drink this? You know, like things like, let's weigh the pros and cons here for a moment. Like, my life has gotten better, you know, since I've not had a drink of alcohol. And yet, like, you know, the other voice was like, but you know, you want it and it's happening right now, so it won't be that bad. Just go ahead, you know. And I drank it, and I literally, it was like the light switch went off. The thinking became streamlined, and it said that 11 months was a waste of your time. And I proceeded to get very, very drunk that night. And the next 3 months, I stayed very drunk. I felt like something inside of me just died, you know, that I was like a shell of a human being walking, just wandering the earth like a hungry ghost, you know, with no purpose, no clue, just kind of going through the motions of somebody who's alive but feeling quite dead. I was obsessed, morbidly obsessed with my own death, and I took joy in nothing. I felt lost. I just felt completely lost. I had no idea. And I, you know, found myself back in those bars downtown, and this time, you know, and I told myself, I didn't say, you've become a street prostitute. I told myself, I'm a fucking liberated woman. You know? I do these things because I have a choice. And I live in an era in which I can make that choice. You know, like just the delusion, like so completely insane. You know, and I put myself in situations in which I should have probably been killed, you know, and that was thrilling to me. It was a long time into sobriety and doing inventory and taking a look at like the real nature of like of the spiritual side of this malady, you know, and before I realized that was the attraction, was that my insides were so sick, I had to make my outsides match in some sort of way. You know, I felt so disgusting and so horrible about myself that it had to balance, you know. The outsides had to match the insides. So I was only out there for another 3 months, and in that time looking back on it now, it certainly seems sufficient, the level of suffering and pain that and the depths that I went to and the types of damage that I did in anybody who dared to care about me during that time. And my friend who had gone to rehab and brought me to my first AA meeting and had a relapse as well, and he said to me, like, you know, I want to go back. I think I'm done. I want to go back. And I didn't feel that way. I was like, that's fine for you, but, you know, I'm doing my thing over here. And he tricked me. He said he didn't drive. You know, he lost his license because of his adventures. But could I please give him a ride down to this? He'd heard about this AA meeting where there were a lot of young people downtown, and he wanted to go back there. It was on a Sunday night, and I was like, well, I can't just drive you down there because it's in the city, and I was terrified of like driving in the city. I was pretty much terrified of everything, but I was terrified of driving in the city by myself. So I wasn't going to drop him off. I was going to go to the AA meeting with him, and I've been sober ever since that night. I walked in there, and it was what was to become my home group, which is now has a membership, a weekly membership of over 500. But at the time, we were about 120 or so, and it was almost equally balanced men and women, which I've come now to understand is quite rare, actually. But there were some women there who they looked amazing. You know, they were all dressed up, and they looked fresh and healthy and full of life. Smiley, bright eyes, they surrounded me. You know, they knew I was new, and they surrounded me. and they asked me a couple of simple questions, you know, like, how are you? No answer. What are you doing tomorrow? Nothing. When was the last time you had a drink? I don't know. You know, someone conveniently had, like, a calendar they brought out, and they helped me figure out when was the last time I had a drink. And they told me that this was very important, that this was a very important piece of information for me to know about myself, that, like, now this was the beginning. This was a new beginning, and it started on that day. And for some reason, you know, every intuition, instinct inside of me was saying, run, you know, run, like, just drop everything, just get out of here as quickly as you can. But, like, I just kept saying, like, okay, and yes, and it was a strange thing, you know, because I was, you know, it's just my story. That's just what happened to me. I wish that I was one of these people who came in because they you know, dragged themselves in, like, please, God, somebody help me, you know. But I wasn't. I was rebellious. I thought I had tried this thing before, and it didn't work for me. I thought I knew better than all of you. I had a horrible attitude. My sponsor used to call me a militant sad ass, and I thought I loved that. I wore it like a badge. It's like, yeah, I'm militant. I have principles. I stand up for something. You know, it's like the wrong set of principles and the wrong standing up for something. But I felt like that almost that entire first year, I had no idea why I kept coming back. You know, I would be with all of you. I would be in your meetings, and I would feel full of the spirit, you know, just like so in love with what was going on here, and like tapped into the energy. And we were doing a whole bunch of things together, like we'd go out bowling after the meeting or to the diner, or like things that I never got to do. I didn't have a childhood. I didn't have a teenagerhood. I was too drunk to have any of those things. And like I was being given permission now, you know, to go to the beach. And stay up way too late and go to the midnight movie, you know, and drink coffee at 2 o'clock in the morning and chain smoke cigarettes. And I was like, this is awesome, you know, this is the best ever. And like, you know, people would say to me, you know, at the end of one of these hangs, they would say, what are you doing tomorrow? And I'd be like, nothing, man. They'd be like, great, this is what you're doing. I'm gonna pick you up, we're gonna go to dinner, we're gonna do this, we're gonna do that, and be like, awesome. And then the next day, you know, I would wake up And I'd be in my routine, and the time would come for me to get in the car to go meet up with people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would feel like, I don't want to. I just want to sit here in my apartment and watch TV, you know, and it was like that fear would beset me again, you know, and some days I would put on my shoes and go anyway, and some days I wouldn't. Some days I would call and make an excuse, or I wouldn't call at all, you know, and I just didn't know. I didn't know what I was doing there. What ended up happening to me was that I started making excuses with my sponsor. I had a real, like, she scared the bejesus out of me. My sponsor was, like, hardcore. You know, if I didn't call her, she called me. She wanted to know what I was doing at all times. She was, like, had me in the steps, you know. And at this point in my sobriety, I had done the fourth and fifth step. I had service positions. I was supposed to be going to a meeting every night. You know, I was very held very accountable in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started calling her and telling her I have to work late, when really I wasn't. I would just get a couple of movies and, like, stay at home and, like, have chill out by myself. And, like, the whole time I felt like I was doing something that I shouldn't be doing, you know, which was, in a way, was thrilling. And it got to a place where I came to a place, a jumping off place, you know, where I knew this one night I was either going to go to the AA meeting, which was a woman's meeting that was held at my sponsor's house, or I was going to go home and I was going to get good and bloody drunk on my way. I had turned 21 during that time, and I was very excited about the possibility of using my ID to buy Guinness, you know. And I don't know why. I think that's why I had been told for that period of time to do these things even when I felt like I didn't want to or I didn't need to. My feet had been trained. I just found myself mysteriously at the AA meeting at my sponsor's house. And I went in there not knowing what was going to happen or what I was going to say, and this woman who's still sober today was sharing, and she was just talking about alcoholism, and without my permission, my hand shot up. I was the first person to share. She called on me, and I told everybody what I had been doing, that I'd been skipping meetings, and that I didn't know if I was alcoholic, and that I thought maybe I wanted to get drunk, but for some reason I was here at this stupid meeting at my sponsor's house, and she scared the crap out of me, and I was terrified of telling her that, and, like, you know, and all this stuff, and, like, you know, people are like, thanks for sharing, you know. And after the meeting, this woman came up. She came up to me, and she had the 12 and 12, and she turned it to page 37, and it talks about the juggernaut of self-will. And as far as alcohol is concerned, you guys can advise me all you like, but everything else is to be my business and my business alone. And then it describes and makes this description about if your own image in the mirror is too painful to bear. And I lost it, you know, tears streaming down my face because something, the moment before she read that to me, was different than the moment after. It was like something very important had shifted, and it's never shifted back, you know, and I think that's the moment that I conceded to my innermost self that what I was alcoholic, and that if I didn't do Alcoholics Anonymous, I was probably going to die drunk, that was the fate for me. And thankfully, I've never had to live in that type of debate again. I've never questioned whether or not I was an alcoholic, you know, of the hopeless variety. Of the type that dies a really disgusting death, you know, and so I got busy as best I could. I mean, I was still just as fearful. I was terrified even, you know, but my sponsor and I got busy doing more of the steps, and I met a man. Well, I'd already met a man. I started dating a man when I was very new in sobriety, which I know some people don't recommend. And given my own experience, I don't know whether I would recommend it or not. You know, it's just my experience. I started dating a man when I was 4 months sober, and for a long time, he was the reason why I kept coming back to meetings. You know, and then he wasn't anymore. But I had that. I definitely had that dependency, and I put him up on a pedestal, and he became, in a way, a higher power to me, and a secondary sponsor. I do not know. I can't tell you whether or not I would have stayed sober. It's a mystery without that. But today I'm grateful that it happened because it was part of the formative experience that I had here. He loved me through all of my sickness, you know, just like all of you did. You know, no matter how belligerent or terrified I was, you always had a seat for me. There was always room for one more. You were always kind. You always welcomed me. And we ended up getting engaged and then married. I was about 2.5 years sober. And the poor guy, you know, that's all I can say. The last time that I shared down here in Madison, I couldn't stop crying at this point in my story. It's going to happen again. I put him through hell, you know. I was emotionally and verbally abusive at every opportunity that I had. I thought that he had tricked me, you know, that he had put this expensive, gorgeous ring on my finger and that I didn't feel any better, you know, and it was his fault that I felt so sick, you know. And I lived this lie. He was amazing, you know. He was the type of alcoholic who walks the walk, you know. He didn't just talk it. I mean, he did this thing. And I always felt like inadequate and less than, and like I couldn't keep up the charade, you know. And the more that I felt threatened with this image, the more abusive I became towards him. And I was about 7 years sober, and I knew that I was going to drink again. I knew it. I felt like I had rotted to death from the inside out. I felt so empty, you know, that same type of emptiness that I experienced when I was drinking. And I thought, well, why aren't I drunk? Why am I feeling this way sober, doing this stupid shit in AA? Like, I should be drunk right now. And so I packed up my bags and I left, you know, and I'll never forget the look on his face, you know, when he came home from work and I sat him down and I was like, I don't love you anymore. I've packed up my stuff and I'm leaving. You know, and it was like watching someone's heart break in their eyes. And But it ended up being one of the best things that I think I ever did for him and for me, because I was forced then, like, the real work needed to begin for me, you know. And I was uncomfortable enough to be willing to do just about anything, you know. I was a full-time student at that time, which was a dream for me to be able to quit working and to just go to school and dedicate my time there. I moved in with a lot of sober people. There was like six of us in one house and like a cat and two dogs. It was like crazy. It was family circus like all the time. I loved it. You know, my mind was like just chattering at me. I literally did not sleep a wink for 3 months. And when I did start sleeping again, it was like an hour here, an hour there. I couldn't eat. People that I sponsored had to come over and cook me meals, you know, and sit me down and make and like spoon it into my mouth, you know, because I was just so, like, the chatter was so loud, it just wasn't present in any way, you know. And I felt like my spirit was just ripping apart, you know, and like it was a battle for my soul. Was the alcohol going to win, or was AA going to win, the spiritual way of life? And I started praying. I had one of those nights where it was 4 o'clock in the morning and I couldn't sleep, and it was so quiet. You know, this house that I lived in was out, sort of, you know, I mean, not like the country like this, but, you know, it was away from any major roads. It was so, so quiet, and there was not a sound out there, and I knew there was nobody that I could call to talk about this feeling that I had, and I thought, I'm going to blow my fucking brains out. I can't stand the way that I feel right now. I can't stand it. And I had this little Boston Terrier that I had raised from 6 weeks old, a little puppy, and she was just sitting on my bed staring at me. And I thought, I remembered somebody saying to me once that animals and babies are closer to God. And I thought, this makes sense to me. Like, this dog has a real third step. You know, she has 100% faith that she's going to be taken care of. And she's happy all the time. I've never seen her sad. I've never seen her depressed. She's never talked back to me. You know what I mean? Like, she just seems to, like, go with the flow and seems to be quite godly in this way. And so that's how I found God. That's how I met God, was that I started talking to my dog. I said, would you pass on a message to me? And it was weird, you know, because she, like, sat up at attention like she knew exactly what I was talking about. And for me, that was just another in a series of spiritual experiences. And I came in here wanting to be an atheist, wanting to be an agnostic, you know, and I wasn't. I did believe in a higher power, but I needed to be convinced. And so I started to have these experiences. You know, when I opened myself up to the possibility, I started having these experiences that I could no longer deny, you know. And that feeling, that sensation, that vibration in the room of Alcoholics Anonymous just got bigger and bigger and bigger and louder, you know, and until that's what my heart longed to be, you know. I love Alcoholics Anonymous today, and I know that because it's where my feet takes me, even though it's not my favorite thing all the time, you know. It's what I love. But I, you know, I found God, and so I just got really super busy in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I ended up graduating somehow. I ended up graduating I did pretty well because AA, the first principle that I learned here was do what you said you were going to do when you said you were going to do it. And that's a really tough one. That's still really tough for me sometimes, you know, showing up where I'm supposed to show up, when I'm supposed to show up there, and being accountable and dressing appropriately and composing myself in a way that, you know, is befitting the occasion. Very difficult. And I was showing up for my life, and I graduated, and the divorce was final, and he was with somebody new now, and I was trying really hard to be happy for him and move on with my life. And he had taken me on our honeymoon to Ireland, and my last name is O'Connor. I'm the other L. O'Connor. The other L. O'Connor is going to speak later. So I come from Irish stock, something happened when I went to Ireland that first time. Like, I felt something wake up, you know, that I didn't know was asleep. It was a sober experience, something I never would have been able to have had I been as insanely drunk as I like to be. A real spiritual homecoming. And I thought at this time, I was like, man, what an amazing world it would be if somebody like me, you know, somebody as disgusting and horrible and despicable and unaccountable and as me could go to college in Ireland, you know. So I graduated, and I was surfing the internet. I found this thing about Trinity College, the master's program that was there, and I sort of cautiously, shyly brought it to my sponsor, and she was like, that sounds like a great idea. Just take it one action at a time, one action at a time. And so I did that, and they accepted me for some reason. And so I went over there. I moved over there in 2006. I was about 8.5 years sober, and it was terrifying. It was absolutely terrifying, but wonderful at the same time. I did exactly what you told me to do. I went from the airport straight to an AA meeting, and I raised my hand, and I said that I was new in town, and I was terrified, and I didn't know what to do. And later that night, someone came to pick me up and took me to another AA meeting where I raised my hand, and I shared that I was terrified and had no idea what to do, and that I would really appreciate a service position and someone to sponsor. And someone came up to me after the meeting, and they were like, oh, you need a service position, do you? Well, we need a new tea maker. And I was like, great, I'll be the tea maker. And I made the tea really bad for a long time because I had no idea how to make tea. but they taught me. They were patient. They patiently taught the stupid American how to make tea. And another woman, an expat from New York, came up to me, and she was like, I haven't had a sponsor in a while. Would you be my sponsor? I was like, that's all I needed. All I needed was to raise my hand and to share honestly about what was going on with me, and everything that I needed was provided. It wasn't an easy experience. It was one of the hardest experiences that I've ever had. And 2 months after I moved there, my sponsor drank again. And she had been my sponsor the entire eight and plus years that I had been sober. And she said a lot of things that were very confusing to me at the end. And I felt like I was at that place again where I didn't know who I could trust, you know. But there was this voice inside of me that kept telling me, there are people here who truly live by principle. They've never let you down. You've never seen them act outside of this code. Call them, you know. So I called the woman who's my sponsor today, Bridget, and I asked her to be my sponsor, and she's still my sponsor today, and it's like one of the best relationships that I've ever had the privilege of being a part of. I've never heard her talk down about anybody. I've never heard her say a negative word. She doesn't tell me what to do. She guides me to have my own experience, you know, and keeps it straight in the book. But I ended up meeting a man. This always happens. I've got like 5 minutes left, and I've got all this stuff to tell you. I ended up meeting a man in an AA meeting, and he was bright and charming and enthusiastic and sober. And we started doing all this AA service together, and we became friends. He'd pick me up for meetings and go pick up newcomers together and do all this stuff. And then, boom, we're in love, you know. And it was a whirlwind. You know, we got married in a fever in a castle in the Irish countryside. We hadn't been dating very long. And then everything got bad. Then the alcoholism kicked in. he stopped going to meetings, and he stopped calling a sponsor. He would go to meetings, but it wasn't the priority, and all the guys that he was sponsoring slowly got other sponsors, and I watched him get, you know, further and further away from this, powerlessly. I had no power over what he decided to do with his life and his time, and nor did I want to. I didn't want to have that kind of power in his life, but I became sicker. As his alcoholism progressed, so did mine, you know, in a way. I became sicker and sicker, and it got to the point where our marriage was hindering on that abusive place again, you know. We moved back here in 2009 in a crisis. You know, I thought, if I get him here, if I get him to the AA here, he'll be okay. You know, we'll get a handle back on this thing, and we'll be happy again. You know, I'll be happy if these outside circumstances start to change. And of course, I knew this was a lie. And I mean, I threw myself right in the middle when I got back to this country. And you know, God provided what I needed. You know, before I knew it, I was sponsoring 10 women again, and they were the focus of my time and my attention. And truly, like a, you know, like I said in the beginning, a bright spot in a very dark night. What ended up happening was about this time last year, and literally like 3 days before I came to speak at Billy's group, was that my husband had an affair, and I almost cringe a little bit to tell you this part, but this is the truth. That he had an affair with a very young woman who was in my sponsorship line, and it was devastating, absolutely devastating. And I felt so bad, I'm going to die. Like, I'm going to die sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and my heart's just going to stop beating, and I'm never going to wake up. And 6 weeks after that, my dad suffered a debilitating stroke. So it was truly a dark night of the soul. I didn't know which way was up, but what I did know was that Alcoholics Anonymous works, and that if I just kept trusting my feet and coming back here, one day at a time, everything was going to be okay. One day at a time, I didn't have to pick up a drink. One day at a time, I didn't have to kill myself. One day at a time, I didn't have to buy a gun and go shoot him. You know? One day at a time, I didn't have to call INS and have him, have him deported. I had some really, like, dark thoughts about all of this. And, like, I literally was able to just do what was best for me. And he put up a huge fight and a huge struggle, and it was an awful experience. But it was like Billy gave me a great compliment before the meeting. He said, "You've always, in times of trouble, you've always turned towards the solution in Alcoholics Anonymous," and that's been the truth, you know. Because like over the past 14 years, it hasn't been all roses, you know. It definitely has not been, you know, this wonderful fairy tale. This is not, as they say, a showcase for the content, you know, but a haven for the suffering. And when I truly bring my suffering to you, I find relief. You know, in the same way that alcohol used to provide, it takes a little bit more time. It's a little bit slower of a process. But what a wonderful, wonderful gift that I've been given. I don't want to hand it back. You know, those moments where I was considering doing things that are less than principled, it's like, oh God, I have an excess of integrity today. Here, please have some back. I don't need all of this dignity. You know, just a little too much. We ended up getting divorced in October, and what happened was I was able to see that first marriage that I had in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was able to have a completely different perspective on truly what the pain that I had caused him that day. And my sponsor had told me when I did an eight step with her, when I first got her, back in Ireland, she told me, this is not an amends that you need to make right now. I think that it would be unwise for you to go seek out this man, you know, and put yourself upon him. I think that this is an amends that needs to be made, but that God will bring you together when the time is right. And I didn't know that it was going to take 6 years. But after my husband, all this stuff had happened, and I had this like moment of clarity, and I realized, wow, that's what that feels like. That's what that feels like. I called my sponsor, and she was like, I bet it happens. I bet it happens really soon. And, you know, not but a month later, I was at a friend's wedding. And not only was my ex-husband there, but his new wife and his newborn baby and his mother and his father and his brother, his mentally ill brother. I came face-to-face with his father, and I knew exactly what I was supposed to do because I had been waiting for this moment for 5 years or 6 years. You know, I made amends. I said what needed to be said, and I made amends. And I thought, if I get to leave here today just with this has been such a gift, you know, such an unexpected freedom that I've gotten to have today. And there, and you know, I was rounding the corner to use the bathroom, and I'm face to face with my ex-husband, and he's holding this little daughter, and he said, "Would you like to hold her?" And this is the first time that he had talked to me, you know? He hadn't talked to me. And I was like, this is my moment. I was like, oh my God, this is happening. This is my moment. We sat down and we talked for, I don't know, 45 minutes or an hour. And I got to tell him all of those things, you know, that I had changed my life. You know, that Alcoholics Anonymous had changed my life, that the higher power had changed my life, and that I was dedicated to this process and the principles that we live by here. And that I was no longer the same person that I was when we were married. And that I was so grateful to him. It was because he was there to pick up my dad when he fell down the stairs on Christmas Day that my dad is sober today. It was because of him taking me on our honeymoon to Ireland that I got to go there and have an experience, you know, and sponsor women and bring the enthusiasm that we have in the D.C. area to Dublin, you know. It was because of him that I didn't have to take a drink at 4 months sober, right or wrong, you know. And that I was so grateful for all the things that he had done for me. And then I acknowledged the hurt that I had caused him. And everything's, you know, it was all forgiven. It was all in the past. God had truly taken both of us on to better things. And I know I'm out of time and I'm running over a little bit, but I wanted to share that story because that had not happened when I got to come here last year, and I hoped that it did. I sat up here at this podium, or the podium over there, crying about how I wished that I could make this amends, so that I really wanted to do it, and the opportunity came, and because of what...